Hello and welcome. My name is Miloslav Sekic. I'm an architect and urban designer here in Austin. I'm originally from Yugoslavia, but I made my home in Austin. I lived here for about 30 years. And when I first walked into the graduate school at the UT School of Architecture Annex about 35 years ago, I met this guy who was doing crazy stuff in the yard, and I said, what the hell is going on here? I learned that that was Pliny Fisk, and that what he was trying to start and organize was Center for Maximum Potential Building Systems, which exists to this day, and with an abbreviated name, MaxisPot, for those initiated, I guess. And it's my pleasure to introduce Pliny today. I've known Pliny for, like I said, for 35 years. We've done a few projects together, and I've been nudging him in the last few years to help me expand the transit to include some of the sustainable design categories and to help us assess the mitigating powers of or opportunities of transit zones to create eco-balance. So he'll be talking about that today. Pliny is considered one of the originators of sustainable architecture and planning movement in the United States and has several national and international awards in that field. At one level, his work has been instrumental in helping formulate local and national policy in green building, while at another, creating the design and engineering criteria for flexible building systems. His research and teaching covers an equally wide range of subject matter, including the development of one of the first design-build courses in sustainable architecture in the U.S. On the planning side, Pliny's resource balancing approach to master planning, called eco-balanced planning, a life cycle-based planning method, is now included in design curriculums of two major universities. Pliny has been instrumental in the development of a series of alternative materials and low-impact building systems, as well as a life cycle-based approach to biophilic-based design, and he'll explain what that means. Pliny's work is considered by some a continuation of the legacy set by Ian McCarg, with a distinctly new approach related to our present conditions of resource depletion and extreme environmental degradation. He teaches undergraduate, graduate, and PhD students at Texas A&M University and continues to work as a co-director of the MaxisPot Center. Pliny has received numerous national and international awards, including the only Earth Summit Award, which was shared with the city of Austin for his work in creating the first green building program in the world, a presidential award for the sustainable planning or towns moved in response to the Mississippi flood, the first ever Sacred Tree Award given by the U.S. Green Building Council, the Solar Pioneer Award given by the American Solar Energy Society. He has recently been appointed onto the National Peer Review Committee for the General Services Commission regarding all major federally funded buildings. Pliny has written many papers on his theories and practices and has been invited to lecture in this country and abroad, averaging about 20 talks a year. In my short tenure as a teacher at University of Texas School of Architecture, I used to invite Pliny to talk to students every semester. And every time he would come, he would just blow their mind. And then for a while, they'd be totally confused. And then after about a month or two, they would come up with some great ideas. And it is my distinct pleasure to introduce my friend, mad scientist, Pliny Fisk.
So, none of this stuff would be possible unless you had friends like that guy, plus quite a number of people in this room that have actually been part of developing this idea, one being Rich McMath, sitting right back there. Put your hand up, please, so you can take some blame for what you're about to see. So, I'm lucky because I'm in Austin, Texas, and you can get away with a lot in Austin, Texas. And they actually listen to crazy ideas, and they bring it to the point where something can happen. So with the four basic areas that we try as a small organization to push in any number of different ways, Austin and the people in Texas have been extremely open. People ask me, why Texas? And I don't know exactly why Texas. Maybe then we think we're still in the frontier zone or something crazy. So Austin, in particular, and friends and associates and people at the center, including the folks that actually funded what you're about to see,
which is a developer that we're working with in San Antonio,
Neil Sav and Scott Polakoff and Bob Anderson and so on, decided that it was important enough to bring us in
that they actually took a share of their contract to pay me because the amount of money that was available to do craziness, of course, did not exist.
So what you're about to see is a work in progress. I think that one of the main purposes of a nonprofit organization is to set viruses for people to pick up on something. Austin Green Builder Program is a wonderful example of that. There are many Green Builder programs going on. USGBC probably gives us more credit than we're due for helping get that kind of thing going. But at the state level, we did the same sort of thing for rewriting the state guidelines. And that, of course, turned into many states doing the same thing. So we're basically in the business of getting a basic, powerful, important, timely way of thinking going and for it to take off. So we try to do architectural design. We are a nonprofit organization. I am not an architect. I am not a landscape architect. I am not a planner. It's the safest thing possibly to be. None. So therefore, nobody knows exactly what I do. So I do a little bit of everything, especially those things that are most exciting. So we've been very involved with master planning, a very special kind of master planning that you'll see one version of today. We decided a long time ago that unless you're involved with policy and not just doing neat things in some secret mountaintop laboratory, that you're not very relevant. So very early on, we got very involved with the city, with the state, nationally, AIA, so on. We've also developed some fairly robust tools that I'm going to hint at a little bit today. But among others, we have what's called, and some of you have never heard of this, unfortunately, because there's not too many examples around. It's what you call process LCA, which is actually building your life cycle assessment up from the base instead of going from the top end and looking at the entire country and working down and beginning to get perspective and hopefully meeting in the middle. So here's what I call the wall-eyed people looking at the big picture. And the cross-eyed people that only look at tiny little things related to process LCA and developing a technique of how we look at impact as a country and as a region or as a building that really respects protocols that are more than just that spot and that moment and that time. So that is going on. And we also have, over the years, tried to gain more and more perspective. My background is with that crazy guy by the name of Ian McCarg, so I've taken that to heart. I used to argue with McCarg more than I did anything, frankly. But the idea that there is a perspective to our work, and there's a context, and that context is biomes, and that what we should be doing is sharing from one part of the world to another in using responsible techniques that actually have to do with that place. So we use that wherever we go. In this case, it was actually working with China and discovering that their techniques were very useful to us in many cases, not all cases, and us to them. And to actually get that kind of relationship going first before you get the craziness of selling TVs back and forth and making believe that that's sustainable. We also, as I mentioned a moment ago, have tried a real sincere perspective as to what we're doing as a country. So we managed to put what's called this IO-LCA together on a GIS basis. So input-output life cycle assessment. So we have 12,500,000 businesses. So when we're asked to spec something, such as the Pentagon or whatever it is, or help a green building program, we can actually set a hierarchy of what it is that that region and that program, whoever it might be, should be doing their lowest hanging fruit and not go to the newest green magazine off the shelf and say, hey, that's cool. Let's use Ray Anderson's carpets today. What do you think? Without any perspective whatsoever as to why to do that. So I am not going to be talking about that today, but I'm bringing these things up to say that there's a lot more depth in what you're about to see than what might appear in an effort to get to that point. So at a community scale, we say life cycle is a way of design. There's impact that you can go and look at outside that boundary, and that's what you just saw. But once you're in that boundary, what do you do? So we actually formulated and redid what Ian McCarg's technique was and began to transform it into actually mapping life cycle and beginning to look at balance and balancing the sourcing of things to the resourcing of things and being able to map that and being able to actually do suitability analysis and be able to make decisions through that. Not going to talk at all about building systems, but we're very involved with building systems from the aspect that if you do not do something on the ground that actually is responding to the things that you just talked about, you've just missed. So we're very involved with that area. We're also quite involved with the whole area of biophilia. I'm not going to talk about this, but we think that the life cycle and the events that people go through on an everyday basis has a tremendous amount to do with what the neocortex is wanting, what the reptilian layer is not really responding to in this fast pattern world that we now live in. And too many of the biophilic people really talk about the reptilian brain and not the neocortex. We think it's a big mistake, and we propose methods of getting around that. So life cycle. So you all know ecological footprints. You know that the U.S. footprint average is actually a little bit worse than that now, but the world footprint is so-and-so per person, and I had to actually give a public presentation the day after 9/11, so I thought I'd create a little commotion and show what the Afghani footprint is per person and why maybe some of that stuff is going on. So that is the amount of eco-capacity that it would mean it would take to support the United States outside the United States boundary. And if I go and I look at a worldwide basis, this kind of thing is obviously getting worse. It's much worse than that in China. But these footprints become the sort of pattern in our mind that is going to be really determining at a fine scale and a broad scale, what are we doing? What's your footprint? As a country, as a person, as whatever. So you can do this at whatever level. You can come right down to London, England, or you can come down to a facility of whatever type. And so in our work with Sharing Nature's Interests and Matisse Wackernagel, we find that these things become very useful for people to understand, and we chose this idea of a cell because people can begin to count cells. So this cell concept and a way of actually flattening the world where you are, and this can be extremely accurate, by the way, where you are. And the rest of the world looks a little bit weird, but where you are is perfectly accurate for you to do whatever you need to do. But it's most important, a visualization technique. So we're very involved with that understanding and trying to actually do something about it. I came to Matisse after understanding what he was doing and said, Matisse, you know, it's great to report in all the bad stuff. What are you doing about it? He said, well, that's up to you, Plenty. I said, thanks a lot. So the balance and imbalance, you can look at the country. You can work your way down. You can go and look at the state. You can go and look at the place. You can go and look at our county of Travis County and keep coming in and begin to say, you know, here's the heart of presumably the Green Builder Program. This is where it all started. How are we doing? What's the truth? If you came down from Mars and you started looking at it, 62% tree cover loss in 10 years, 56% worse in water use. And mind you, the city is basically the county. This isn't a little city and a huge county sitting out there. This is it. So when we're talking about how well we're doing and critiquing ourselves and critiquing our own city and critiquing our own program, it's the kind of thing we got to do. So when we look at these things, we begin to say, you know, that technique for how are you doing where you are and how are you doing at a worldwide basis and how is perhaps the technique and approach and framework the same, and that you're not changing every time that you look at a house or a town or a country. So life cycle, in its essence, is pretty simple. Here's a life cycle. You ready? Source. Resource. What was the footprint? First was about 5,000 square foot of a temperate forest, a healthy temperate forest, good soils, good understory, good upper story. That's how much land it takes me to breathe as a person. If I go and it's about 7,500 square feet. So it takes more land to go and actually absorb the carbon. Now, the crazy thing about that is that there is no planning, nothing going on that actually gets into that simple kind of level of the sourcing and the resourcing of whatever that you're talking about that supports you as a person or a city. We are just going on our way, mostly a conservation approach, not a cyclical approach. So one of the most important things that we do is we look at life cycle as a cycle. And what it means to me is sustainability is a sustaining process. It is not a conserving process. It is a flow and the control of flow and intensity of flow. But keep the flow going. So as we look at this and we fiddle with this and we get into all the different things it could be, the water, the air, the food, the energy, the materials. And I'm not going to get into right now the context that this sits in because there are really two ends of the book. I wonder why this keeps changing. This will be an interesting presentation. Just keep me going here. So the two ends of the book says hazards and says ecology, leave it. So we're talking about land and situations between those extremes as to how we begin to work with that. So we can go to this scale. We can go and critique the building that the state funded us to do, which is the state green building demonstration, which is our office. How do we do? You know? Air? How do you, it's such a foolish thing of saying there's a boundary to air. There's no boundary to air. The air keeps coming across that boundary. How do you possibly say that? And I say, that's the problem. We're not thinking in boundaries. We're not thinking of context and the balance within a procedure of thinking that has boundaries. It always goes on to the next and the next and the next and the next. And pretty soon you say, oh, I can't do anything because it all is happening someplace else. So therefore you take no responsibility. So as we got into this, we began to say, all right, some are over, some are under, doing really well. We could actually share with somebody next door. Now, we have this going on in master planning, as I showed a little bit. I'm not going to get into too much of the footprint master planning in this way, but I'll be getting into it another way in a moment. But it's just to give you an idea to penetrate the mind, to go and say, well, you know, that process could be used in any number of different situations. So interns picked up on it. So here are these French interns. My French isn't very good. Took us a while to get together on this, but they said, you know, we're going to go for a competition in Europe. I said, good luck. Sorry about this timing. I don't know why this timing is happening because I didn't time this thing. And I said, well, go ahead. So they said, guess what? We won. You won? This is a professional competition and you won? You're kidding. Well, not only that, you know, we've taken this and this become my thesis at my school. Really, your college, university, architecture department in Paris, huh? Yeah, and he says, end of that, he says, you know, Plenty, couldn't believe it. They really liked the presentation. They really liked the concept. And they gave me the student prize for graduation. But you know something? As I really talked to them, they actually didn't understand what I did. They were so impressed that somebody was thinking about this, though. So the idea that you're doing well at one level, or not so well, but you are pushing off to the next level. And so this idea of balance where you are, and if you're not balanced, where's it going? What's needed at the next level? So the U.S. is pretty far off. This is conservative, by the way. NASA says we're about 22 times off. This is sharing nature's interest, and they say we're 2.7. So all the activity of people compared to the land and the vegetation is that far off. So that's why you need so many countries, or in this case, why you need so many counties. This is King County in Seattle, because centrally, Seattle is a town, just like Austin, where you don't have to talk very much, and they begin to understand fairly quickly, and they say, go, here's a contract. We want this perspective in our green building program, because we don't know where to start, and we don't know where to go. So we did quite a lot of work with King County. But then you look at the complexity of things going on. You look at the life cycle, and the life cycle says, all right, conserve, conserve, conserve. Lower your emissions. Get your carbon in balance. But they're not actually going and saying, how do you create at every step of the process, at every scale, sinks? This isn't going to some gigantic multi-billion dollar process of taking carbon out of the atmosphere and blowing it into the bottom of the sea. This is everybody, every scale, every moment. So we began to look at this kind of thing, and everything that we found, we could balance. Now, I'm going to shift here for a moment, and this is my office calls this scope creep. You know what scope creep is? When you take a very defined project, and all of a sudden you go off to the side, and nobody knows exactly why you're doing this, and they hope to goodness that it comes back again. And it makes sense. So this is very interesting to me. If I were to go and look for what are the most sustainable things that I can find on the planet with a history of humans on the planet, that first of all, I begin to look at some of the things that were going on before we totally, what's the word? I could use a bad word. I'll just use the word we fouled up. So there's so little example of what was going on here because of disease, because of all the other things. These civilizations are gone. And with them, all the things that are important. So it's interesting to me that if I look at Mexico City, and don't ask me to pronounce the right name, that there were that many people way back. And if I compare that to other big cities at the time, our European ancestors, this is much better. This is sustaining more people because of how they looked and worked with resources without the inputs that we have. And you can argue lifestyle, you can argue all kinds of things, but they were doing it. However that was, they were doing it. And so I keep looking at this and I look at, you know, the studies that anthropologists have been doing. It's basically a cyclical situation that was the core in how they were operating. And multiple cycles. There was no food or energy or water or waste or this. It was totally integrated together. And that city was a very successful example of perhaps some things that we could borrow from. If nothing else, from that framework. And then there's this other crazy thing. So not too long ago, this whole idea of Amazonia and El Dorado was fictitious. It was written about by some crazy monks who came on some of those ships. And they started about, I would say, 10, 15 years ago, starting really investigating, because they were coming up with patterns in the Amazon of how things were growing that did not make any sense if it was purely nature. So they started fiddling around. They started realizing that there was a very special soil type, terra preta. And terra preta was a soil type that was developed because of the way they were burning the land. Because of the way they were burning the land, two things happened. One was they were enriching that soil many times what a normal soil was. And number two, they were sequestering a tremendous amount of carbon. So there's some of the patterns. And they began to find all sorts of waste ceramics and waste this. And so in essence, saying that the Amazon was actually created, size of France, by people, we don't connect to that. We don't connect to it because we have been taught that we're separate from nature, that we are not part of that system. And there's a school of thought in the anthropology, archaeology area that says the most healthy environments known on this planet have had people intimately connected to those environments. And the ones that we put into a pristine position are the very ones, like the Amazon, that might very well have been created because of people. And that's a very, very important psychological shift, because it begins to say we are far more possibly responsible than we'd like to admit. And what is going on here is that both are improving. Nature's improving, as well as the support systems that people have. And when you combine those two together, you get, we think, extremely powerful ways of doing things. Recently, I went through a little survey through all our friends' books. These are good books, good friends. Doug Farr, Dan Williams, all the people we read about. And I just sort of went through those, and I went through even Ian McCarg's stuff way back. And I tried to do one very simple thing. I tried to see how many times were people actually put into a cycle of things with nature. Incredibly seldom. That means we are not designing from the very first moment that we think of a project with nature, and that we are part of a cycle with nature. But of course, what's interesting also is the industrialists are doing this. The whole idea of industrial ecology is working by this concept. Sort of a plus ultra concept. If you did not integrate to this extent, you are not getting the productivity coming out of the system that you were thinking. Because in actuality, if you did it well, you're getting much more productivity. So I kept looking. This is an embarrassing situation. You know, you're brought to China because you know what you're doing. You're an American and you know about sustainability, and you're going to suggest to the Chinese what they should do. Right. So the first thing I did is that I said, you know, this is what we're doing wrong. But the fascinating thing, as usual, if you know what's going on in the world, if you go down the road about, I think it was 90 kilometers, what some of the world thinks is the best integrated farming, most productive farming on Earth, you're already doing. Why do you have us here? The National Academy of Sciences, this is their final farm example of where the world should be going. It's right down there. So, of course, I compare all this to the way an ecologist would think. So my background got very involved with Howard Odom and a number of people of this nature. And the complexity that they begin to understand compared to what we understand as planners and as architects and designers. Would we ever, ever even suggest that degree of complexity behind us? And I look at some of the things, this is out of Doug Farr's book, and I do not see that cyclical way of thinking. I do not even see it with Arab, considered one of the best engineers that we have. And the funny thing about this, if you look at the bottom of it, you see this, I don't quite know what it is, it sort of looks like a mushroom something. So there's a mushroom on one side and a mushroom on the other side. There's no arrow going between the mushrooms. That means mushrooms happen someplace else, not here. You're doing what you can here, but you're not talking about the six cycles that are needed to be talked about where you are. So in the landscape architecture and planning arena, they sort of have been comparing conventional, Ian McCarg, and eco-balance. And to what extent these things are cycling within the eco-balance, and to what extent a linear process is working with a lot of the planning that's going on, including McCarg's planning. So gradually I begin to come up with a definition. The ecology of regenerative systems, or those living systems that sustain over time, are based on cyclical patterns of resource use. When these cycles, air, water, food, energy, materials, symbiotically function with each other into a complex web of life, productivity is heightened to the extent that both nature and humans benefit beyond the capacity of either functioning unto itself. So you got the idea. I hate to read. I don't want to repeat. Eco-balance is an interoperable framework. So a lot of folks say, you know, don't know what you're talking about. I say, well, I've been involved with the solar movement for a long time. Passive solar depends on heat gain, heat loss. It's basically a balanced process. If you really know what you're doing, you do not need anything extra in many parts of the world, but you have to really know what you're doing. And I keep going through this, and I say, you know, the biologists, the flora, the source, the fauna, resources. If I look at any number of these things, the engineer, the hydrologist, the LCA analyst, or whoever, the ecologist, the producer, the consumer, even the civil engineer on site, the cut and the fill. So as we got into working with Verano, a town that we're doing in San Antonio with a number of people in this room, we ran into an interesting phenomenon, and that is a phenomenon that many of the tools that we were all using, and my wife, by the way, is the chair-elect of the U.S. Green Building Council now, so luckily she's not here. But what I'm going to say relates to LEED as much as it does to smart growth folks. This is not a list. The world is not a list. We do not check things off. In fact, we have to go and study those lists so carefully because we've got to inject things into it in order for it to become a cycle. And if you don't do that, all you're going to become is a checkoff guy. So as we looked at this and we began to look at the seriousness of what has to be done and hopefully begin to communicate with the engineers that this is the way to do things, that we started saying, all right, this is a global process. This isn't so special to us. And as you look at that, air, food, etc., it's a balanced system. Why not take that sourcing and resourcing and look at the transects for new urbanism? And look at it from the nature end as well as the urban end. And in between, transform our mapping process a little bit. At one end, it's flora and fauna. It's very interesting when you really, as in a moment I'll show you, really looking at flora and fauna, you're looking for the things that create, that continue the cycles in that relationship. This isn't just, oh, the black cat burial is a good thing to save, because the environmentalists say that there's an extinct, you know, extinct species. I'm looking for things that really, really seriously continue that cycle. The land and the building, that's the easiest. But often when we get to the urban environment, what do we have? We don't have a lot of land. We've got a lot of ingenuity related to what's going on in buildings. The unfortunate thing is we only look at a building. We're not looking at the ecology between buildings. And we think that that in itself could be a regenerative system far beyond what we're now talking about. And we have a little bit of indication that that's true. So that's the pattern. And that's what we're trying to do. So we're looking at nature and we analyze and find out all those critters that are needed. The client comes along and says, we're going to have ocelots and moles in everybody's backyards. Not quite going that far, but it would be interesting to actually take open space systems and begin to figure out how to cordon them off in such a way where those critters could be there and that you're almost part of that system, not totally ridiculous. So a few of these I'm going to go through a little bit quickly so that we can make sure that we're getting done, because as I go through, they'll become more and more understandable. And many of these things are things that you know about, but most of them are put into conditions where these cycles could happen. The building to building is very interesting, because the building to building, as you get into some of the things going on out there, a very special one that came up, and I can't remember what project this was. Here we had a laundromat sitting next to a drive-through bank. Extraordinary amount of roof area in this drive-in bank. Drive-in bank isn't going to use any water. Drive-in bank isn't going to take the PVs and plaster it on that roof and use the amount of PVs that you have on the roof. But the building next door could. And you begin to look at all the different buildings, and you begin to see incredible possibilities and patterns going on between buildings if you take this kind of balanced perspective. So we began to get into our point system. Now, for a while, and this is why I'm not an architect and not a planner, I was basically told, Pliny, don't touch the list. And I said, great, you're paying me to do so much here, but I'm going to go and in the my time, and I'm going to touch the bloody list. Because if I don't touch the list, I'm going to be doing craziness. So I began to touch the list. Began to touch the list in several different ways. Began to touch the list related to what that particular best management practice was related to. Was it a source or a resource? Could it be a business on the site? Because one of the things you begin to realize, a lot of these transformation things can be businesses. So if you actually flip this, we almost did this with Ron Hubert over here. Didn't quite have enough money to pull it off, but next time, Ron, we're going to do it. How much could we actually reflect the flow of money with the flow of water or materials or energy in this same kind of thing, and begin to show how many jobs you're creating by beginning to get more and more integrated? So we kept doing this, and I'm not going to go through this whole thing. You get the idea. And what began to happen, began to get multiple integrations going on. So every time that you did one thing, if you were really wise, you would be doing many things for economic purposes and so on. And then the interns, of course, went crazy. They said, whoa, you know, maybe this gets back to your ecosystem stuff that you keep preaching to us and those crazy diagrams playing. So they did this one for me about 2 weeks ago. This is cool. It's called the spider diagram. So now we're beginning to get really multiple systems going on. So then we said, all right, it's getting there. It's not going to be quite what that is, but at least we have a starting point to do one other very, very important thing. And that is to develop the framework to understand the scale of balance. So we started footprinting. We started footprinting from an individual T3 lot. We went and looked at the building, what could possibly be done, the landscape, what could possibly be done, the streetscape, the open areas around the building, and what was left over, we pushed into what we're calling the research center. Now, in this case, the research center is a very interesting situation. It's all of this. Because this is Verano. This is the new Texas A&M campus. So now, with Texas A&M being what? Agriculture Mechanical School. With a new president that happens to be female for the first time in their history and might understand this kind of thing. And Mexican, that's another plus. Well, actually, she's Cuban. That's even better. And so, the leverage possibilities I just mentioned to our clients in the hall is that a very interesting thing happened. I was written up in Texas Monthly as being supposedly one of the people to help determine the future of Texas, and she immediately sent letters out to the whole campus because there were three people from A&M and nobody from UT. It's the only reason she sent the letters out. But I said, there's my ticket. Now I can go in and say, hey, you know, what you actually saw in Texas Monthly isn't anything like what I'm planning for your campus. Really? What's that? So we started doing the air. Now, this is not done yet. This takes a lot of time and a lot of work, and there is no pay behind what you're about to see. So be gentle with me. So now we're beginning to overlay. And overlay is very interesting because now some of that wastewater is going into that forest. And what was the forest doing in the air? The forest was giving you the air. However much it was giving, it might not be balanced, but however much it was doing. But now when I put the wastewater in, what happens? Proven. 18% increase in carbon sequestering in the forest because of your wastewater. Now you're beginning to get multiple cycles beginning to work and overlay with each other that says, you know something? If you really kept doing this, you could actually begin to approach those cities, perhaps, that we're looking at as simply models that could never be approached again. And those overlaps and overlaps, and I can go through 50 to 100 of these overlaps to say that is the kind of integration we need between these cycles. And what happens is you go through that bottom and you can't do it, you can't quite do it, it doesn't quite balance, then you're going to that next level. So what is happening here, again, is fairly obvious. The food has something to do with air. Some of the food has something to do with actual taking of that, some of that wastewater. Some of that food can be in yards, but some of that food has to get into very sophisticated systems if you're going to be getting into high-density conditions and not continually pushing off to the next level. So in some cases, we review on a global scale what's going on with really intensive but ecological food systems and trying to get, hopefully, A&M and people to take it seriously. So it's interesting. I mean, this is an example of heavy timber frame buildings grown with megaflora. Megaflora grows fast. It's extremely strong. It needs no pesticides, none of the things that are normally needed. It's grown in 38 countries. You've got to be careful of it. You don't want it to spread. That's some of the research that has to happen. You begin to bring these things together with your wastewater, with some of the material systems, with some of the air systems, and now you're sequestering far more with that plant, almost to the extent that you're doing bamboo, which is considered one of the best, but this is a tree. Now, an environmentalist and an ecologist in the room would just begin to tear this apart because I'm possibly bringing in invasive species, I'm possibly doing this, I'm possibly doing that. But what I'm doing is at least getting the discussion going. Right now, there's no discussion. And then there's some cool things, you know. This crazy buffalo gourd in Texas, you ever seen it? It's about the size of a... They used to play lacrosse. It's exactly the size of a lacrosse ball. Totally round. What's in the middle of it? You got a seed. It's a polyunsaturated oil. All you have to do is squeeze out of that, the oil, put it through a filter, and it goes right into your diesel engine. It grows in an uncontrollable manner in Texas. It takes over people's lawns. This old kook up at Texas Tech has studied every single one of these strains and said, this is the one. And by the way, the pulp, that's good for your alcohol. very fascinating. If A&M ever had the guts to do this kind of thing, huh? Food, water integration. You know, if I go to Asia and I go to Bangkok, go to any place like that, they're producing 10% of their total food supply in the city. How do they do that? They have to do that. It has to be right there. There's no big transportation system to go flitting around in the hinterlands to get your morning eggs. So they really massively integrate this thing. Those are superb examples of how we could begin to understand the ways that it would need for high density farming. Now, in this country, people say, well, any examples? And we know an example. How many of you have read The Omnivore's Dilemma? So you know Polyface Farms in Virginia. An absolutely astounding example of doing exactly the same thing that we're talking about here. There are other examples. Most important thing, we need a list of all those examples. Zeri in South America is doing incredible work along the very same lines that I'm talking about. Among others, the permaculturists are doing wonderful work. So every one of these has a little bit different tone to it. It's producing, the inputs are a little bit different, the outputs are a little bit different. The outputs begin to communicate and work with the inputs of another, beginning to get, in this case, a glue, that's sugar-based glue. And then we can begin to say, well, maybe some of this begins to work. Unintegrated footprint area, integrated footprint area. Actual footprint required to balance T3. Could it fit? We don't know yet because we're only at T3 at this point. Then the shocker is, what does it take? So here you're at T3 and you're really, really studying that small lot. And I don't know whether any of you have heard of evidence-based design, but evidence-based design is saying, look, show, go along with the evidence. Don't assume. Don't assume style. Don't assume anything. What does the evidence say? And as you go through that evidence, you begin to realize that how home is now presently thought of might not be how we have to think of it in the very, very near future. And the yard and what's in the home and how the home works. Likewise, when we talk about T6, there are implants into that urban environment that we know nothing about at this point in time. It's sad. So there's biochar kilns going on now. There's 10 universities going and doing biochar work to get that char back into the soil to improve soils while you're making energy. Not bad. You're producing your carbon monoxide, you're using your gas, you're taking the waste from your energy system, you're putting it into the ground, and you're growing better. The very fuel that you burned. Or high-rate composting, multi-level. It's been going on in Europe for the last 30 years. So here you have a compost system that actually is intensive. And by the time it reaches the bottom of that compost system, 2 weeks, from raw garbage to incredible soil done. Now, I'm not even talking about taking the biochar and mixing it with the compost. That question hasn't been asked. Or the fact that Canada is doing biosteel, taking the char, same char I've been talking about, into a steel operation, using that carbon monoxide to get the temperatures up for steel. So they have two or three of those going on, or vertical gardening systems. Now, these things don't fit very well into the regular scene. So, my good friend Milosav and Bob Anderson, who is the landscape architect working on this, who is the same landscape architect that did the Wildflower Center and many other things around us, say, go for it. Nobody even suggests or proposes this. It's never even going to be connected to anything. So we've got these multiple things going on, the replacement of certain kinds of buildings with these machines that right now are foreign to us. So we look at the T6. I sneak in building systems. These are building systems that are basically monocoque construction. Shells. Shell construction on all those posts and so on. But within that complex, I begin to say, how can I really, really integrate all these things together? And how much could I do there without, what's going to happen some other place again? And we're not sure of this, obviously, because we're just on the side playing. So anyway, where am I in this presentation? Is that my last one? Can't be. Oh, no, look at this. Okay. So I have to say that not all of this has all been carefully fit in to Verano yet. This is what you call your nonprofit weirdness trying to overlay itself onto beautiful new urbanism. What will happen? What is the next step? Can it work? Or are they going to be totally foreign to each other? So this is what is planned. I keep thinking that maybe some of these buildings are actually totally hollow and have in them some of these secret ingredients. So who did these drawings? What was the person's name again? Is she here? Really? There she is. Unbelievable drawings. I want you to come over to my place sometime. Don't go over to his place all the time. Come over to me. Pretty close by. We could do great together. But of course, Milosav does the original, and then you two work together and create magic. Anyway, that's it, folks. And we're going to let it open for questions. God, it's the first time I've been on time for the last 5 talks. I must have done something wrong. There must be loads of questions or answers. Or that's the craziest, weirdest presentation I've been at yet at the New Urbanism Conference, and I'm in Austin, Texas, and I expected that, though. So it's okay. We're breaking ground in August?
For the first road, yes.
First road in Verano is August.
15, 20 years.
And where is it in relation to
San Antonio? It's on the southeast edge of San Antonio. 410 goes on the north part. It's between basically the Toyota factory and 410. I know that guy. Good question. Okay, so the question is, high density is good. High density can get you into an issue of how much you have to put outside. How can you make, I'm going to put a few words into what he just said, because I never repeat anybody, as you can tell. How do you make a good living environment at that density with all these other things going on. But, well, say it again, say your last part again.
Well, it's the idea that this, the land area required to support that dense urban be on that site.
Right. 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 Okay. So, right now, if I go back and I try to answer that question from what we've done at this point, and I have to say, we have, do not have the T5. We don't have T7 in this figure. All we have is the fact that that is the amount of area that it takes in this situation. In other words, that's the amount of area that we presumably have. What's going on here? There's another one. Oh, my goodness. They're everywhere. So that was the amount of area that it would take beyond the T6 to fit into that amount of land area outside that. As integrated as we can get it at this point in time with our knowledge. Now, we do not have all the other transects included there yet, and the amount extra that each one of those need. We are trying in the next month or so, and I have permission to do this in my operation, to take, I have two wonderful interns. I have an intern from India who's just going nuts about this. She refuses to stop working, and she works half the night. And then another one from China. So they are so totally connected that it's unbelievable. So we'll see what happens. And I, you know, I wish I could answer the question better because I can only answer the question to that extent. And I don't know how the crowding is going to happen. Yep. Yep.
My sense is that you'll never make dense urban areas attractive enough to communities until you integrate those green features that you say there's not room for. So I think that you're not, there may be some optimal area, place along the transect that stuff really apply. And you'll leave a lot of variability so people who have different market preferences can move into different sets of different balances.
Exactly. Well, yeah. And I don't know if anybody's hearing this. Can anybody hear what he just said? When somebody talks, could you turn around so I don't have to try to repeat all this incredible question stuff that I'm getting? My belief is this. I'll repeat one thing again, and that is we haven't even investigated properly what we're talking about here. So it's wide open. But what I would suggest is that what we're going towards is a non-fixed solution. It's going to be something that is a plug-and-play evolution of what has to occur. And the building systems that I'm proposing at the T6 level enable that variation and openness and flexibility to happen over time. So it's really the epitome of open building, and I'm sure many of you know what that is. It's an international effort to push flexible, really sophisticated building systems. And if you don't do that, I don't think that you could really handle this because the discoveries that are going to be made once you start doing it is extraordinary. Rick?
Just a comment, I think, because the battle came across clear, but you could, the boundaries, the T1 to the T6, you get food production zones for all of those.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't have food production just in T1.
Exactly. And I get, did anybody not get that, by the way? I'm testing my presentation here. There's somebody that just does not understand that? You didn't understand it? What's the matter with you? I'm sorry, go ahead. How many people here are associated with Verano? You want to answer that question?
Well,
Well, at this point, it's a group of investors from Las Vegas. And the two people that we work with directly actually may be part of the developing team, as far as I know.
And there are many of these things that I'm talking about, as I might reiterate, that are never going to happen. Partially it's as an exercise. I run a crazy nonprofit organization. I'm in a weird town. I'm hoping. That's all I can do, is present and hope.
With great difficulty, I can tell you.
That's exactly the way I feel. Well, okay, I'll repeat again. The way this happened is the team got together. I had a certain amount of impossible contract, in other words, tiny. They said, well, we'll let Fisk on the team, see what happens, as long as he doesn't create too much commotion. But I started getting into this, and everybody began to say, you know, we'll put some of our contract money into this. So I had a total of, should I say it? $20,000 to do what you're seeing here. That's the state of the situation. What do you mean, all that? Everything that you see here? They're building. Which one of these do I use? There's lots of them. They're building that. The reason that I can even propose what I'm talking about here is that this is open possibility. ANN has no plan. ANN could do a miraculous job of balancing what's going on here. What we've got to do is show a really good effort at what it is that we're doing here in order to even open the discussion with A&M, who's an agricultural mechanical university that has every crazy ag system, megaflora system, whatever you can imagine, in their coffers. Have they ever applied it to anything like this? No. You're very welcome. Probably everybody has the same question, by the way. Yeah. They are doing, this is research grounds and campus. This entire thing. The whole thing is 2,500 acres. You can proportion it out. This is about one third of the whole. Yep. You have to talk loud. Well, that's a good question. I have a paper called The Seven Principles on my website. And you can get my website off of here. I can't remember. What is my website? What's our website?
CNPBS.org.
CNPBS.org. Thank you very much. So we have lots of papers. One of the papers is Seven Principles that we've developed for a project at the time, I think it was in Montana. It was the NIST building. And one of those is to look at the number of steps in any transformation process, whether it be life cycle or whatever it be, and the degree of efficiency with the number of steps that you go through. The more you're integrating, it is astounding how the efficiency within a whole life cycle process increases. So to answer your question, the ingenuity and inventiveness of how we as designers and we as engineers all working together can really get these things fundamentally new ways of thinking about, you know, what is food about? What is the waste from food about? How are those things beginning to be, you know, I'm working with a group in Vietnam that has a what they call a biopod. A biopod uses, believe it or not, soldier flies to treat sewage. The soldier flies reduce the amount of physical quantity to a fraction with incredible nutritious elements within it that could be taken as a small item now and taken someplace else. So it's not one of these things where if you don't think about all the technologies that are needed combined with what it is that you're doing here, there's not a chance. Because you're talking in some cases about large, bulky items that have to be reduced and have to get efficient. When I talk about this biochar for production of carbon monoxide, I'm assuming that you have pretty efficient piping, like vacuum sewage that's going on in Finland and different parts of the world, that you're vacuuming this stuff through very efficiently, in and out, so that your productivity, your chipping technology, your pelletizing technology is being brought in to that unit. Without that, I'm not going to have trucks going up and down with chips down the center of that beautiful boulevard that these guys designed. So you begin to have to really bring all that stuff together. Great question. Yeah. Well, let me put it this way. The first drawings, the rainbow cycles that I was going through, those have been gone over by the engineer and the developer. The concept is understood. Part of it is being balanced. To the extent of what I'm talking about in balancing and all the elements that it would actually take, no. But the very fact that this is reached to the point of a discussion here and that they have been open, that this can be within that beautiful report that's about to go out to the city of San Antonio, that people can get a hold of and look at and study, that's happened. I'm old. Well, I look at tiny little increments.
Pliny, if I could add just one bit of information here. About 1/3 into the process of urban design, the clients got really frightened by this presentation. And what we finally were able to negotiate with them is to allow us to try to balance two variables, energy and water. And that's what we are. We're trying to balance within the project the water generation and use and the energy generation and use. And that's where we are.
And food, for example, could not be part of it. Yep. Well, in a project like this, if I over-concentrate in one of those or the other, well, let me put it another way. If I'm sorry. I can't repeat all these things here. These are great questions. Here.
What I said was one of Pliny's early slides describes a cell.
One of Pliny's early slides described a cell and used the cell as the unit for projecting the footprint. And I was just saying, in the urbanism, there are three basic units of urbanism: the neighborhood, the district, and the corridor. And I wonder, I would welcome Pliny's thoughts on using those rather than, you know, T3 through T6, which are components of neighborhoods, but are not themselves the cell, if you will, of urbanism. The cells of urbanism are neighborhoods, districts, and corridors.
Well, from the tiny amount that we are beginning to realize pattern-wise in this, is that the more diverse that you have land and building types together in what you're calling a cell, that we believe the opportunities are much greater. When you only work within certain scale, in effect, if you work within a T-zone, you're working with also certain scales of technologies. You're not doing too much mixing. As soon as you get to those edges, the mixing possibilities are much, much greater. It's interesting, we've collected a lot of very far out restaurants that are going up around the world that have, you know, their whole fish system and their vegetable system and all these things all integrated, and you sit in your restaurant and you look through and you see all this. And you begin to realize, wow, you know, there's a whole bunch of your cycles going on right within the restaurant. But then, where do you place that? The placement of that is, like many other things are placed, but it also has these other issues of what other cycles are needed for the placement of that restaurant. And that kind of, you know, new edge between these cycles of things could be at the edge of cells, we're not sure yet. But we think that diversity of possibilities, both at the edge within that kind of cell diversity, is better, much better.
Well, Pliny, would it be fair to say that the analysis you did was actually done for the neighborhood, both urban and not so urban? I mean, both T3 and T6. We just took the edge conditions because, you know, those were the two ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what is going to happen if I were to sort of project the next step, these intensive farm systems were going to be very close to the urbanism. It's not going to be pushed all the way down to the hinterland someplace. The big megaflora plantations, the big greenhouses, the big sewage treating forests and all that are another scale, and they will not be right there. So that and I should have shown this, the reason that I'm very interested in these small integrated farms is that they could be very close to some of these cells and very connected to the town. You guys are serious. You're sitting here still and wondering what's going on? Yes, sir. Well, the financing is particularly interesting, and the only way that I can try to answer that at the moment is that you are much more into a realization that everybody can be a producer. and that the diversity of possibilities of what production and consumption is, and how that links not only in the physicality of doing that, but also in, well, the way I look at the evolution of these things is as much going on, or more and more going on, related to information sharing about who has what in a peer-to-peer relationship as there is a monetary flow. And one is beginning to replace the other. And that peer-to-peer thing is going on heavily, as we know, on the web. And that would be very, very much a part of how this would really function. And, I don't know whether anybody is familiar with what's called flexible manufacturing networks. But flexible manufacturing networks in Europe is what actually started the CDCs in this country. And it was actually brought here by an architect by the name of Richard Hatch at the New Jersey Institute of Technology. And the idea of flexible manufacturing is that you have many, many small businesses all brought to the point of really having state-of-the-art capability, technically, monetarily as to how they run their business. But what is very different about it is that it's looked at as a large organism. So in Italy, a scooter is produced by hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of smaller businesses. We produce a scooter out of a large business, large factory. It's a totally different way of operating. The reason that this has never taken off, by the way, according to Richard Hatch in the United States, is that we're very, very protective of information within our individual businesses. To actually let somebody else know what's in your storage and how your books are kept and flip back and forth is unheard of. You couldn't possibly even suggest that to what's going on at the moment. However, if I go to Silicon Valley, flexible manufacturing is going on everywhere. Now, whether they actually get to the point of knowing what everybody's doing in every single way, shape, and form is another issue. But you get to know in just-in-time manufacturing, if you have a network of different manufacturers, you know what's in that storage area. So there's a jump related to, is this coming in as a finance process, or is this coming in as a way of thinking about a plug-and-play way of thinking about business in a very flexible manner that we are not quite there yet in everyday business terms. But it is happening. Computer industry would not exist if that were not taking place. And the protocols in that industry are totally shared and understand between everyone. Otherwise, you can't enter. It's the same thing here. There are certain protocols, certain basic ways of operating and sharing information and working with each other that we are not nearly at the point of understanding. Yes, sir. This could go on for a while.
Given the fact that they have excluded air.
Good questions, by the way. I like that question.
Will this study be able to convey the inherent law of limiting the two variables in this?
The two variables of what?
Air and food. Energy.
Well, it depends. Are you talking about the sink of air or the supply of air?
No, I'm saying they are. You're only studying water and energy for this project.
Oh.
Oh,
yeah, there's a big problem.
Presenting this study, will you discuss the inherent flaw of eliminating the variables that have an impact on everything?
I will try. If it gets to that next stage, I would love it. The class, we're going to be here tonight. Is Ralph and Tom here? They're not here. Oh, well. There's a problem right there. We're not actually having our open house tonight because basically I'm here. It's also, I think, raining and damp out there, but normally we do have an open house the first Friday of every month. You're absolutely right. And they're wonderful creatures that happen to come to that open house, and it's totally word of mouth, and businesses have happened, marriages have happened, people have found their lost sons. It's unbelievable. It's at 6:30 as summer approaches, and we'd love to have anybody. Yeah. But you've already asked a question. That person hasn't.
And the result of what?
Density.
This will take a long talk, but you're absolutely right. And the carbon footprint, to be very honest with you, much too much concentration on carbon footprints. That's one thing. I mean, there is such water crisis about to happen in this state that is unbelievable. Now, there is a carbon part of water, but the interesting thing to me is that the carbon amount has to do with the wastewater end of these things could be a significant component in the carbon end and solve significant problems in the water end. That discussion is barely happening. That discussion happens about, well, I haven't even had the discussion in San Antonio. Well, let me answer it another way. When we did our IOLCA for the country, if you have toxic release in that inventory, which we did, there are so much more important issues related to toxicity going on in the environment. It is just going to be the driver to a lot of other things that aren't even on the drawing board because we are focusing on carbon. I would love to talk to you about the IOLCA model that we have sometime because it looks at these things together, number one. This isn't, you know, and then it puts everything in some kind of a hierarchy so you know where to begin to start to solve the problem in that particular facet of the built environment. What we really need is a strategy for all these things that really looks across the board instead of this vertical thinking stuff. When we have that going on, then we have a national strategy and program to what we have to do. But everything's fate. I mean, it wasn't the feds did not actually realize what we were doing until we were specking the Pentagon. And they looked at this thing and they said, whoa. We should be doing that in every single building in the country. Yeah, we've been saying that for years. I tell you what, if Gore gets in, this will become national policy.
If I could,
I mean, everything's fate. It's just an astounding fate situation.
If I could make one comment in the end, and that is every time I listen to Pliny, I realize how woefully inadequate my education and my professional knowledge is. And to paraphrase Einstein, he said, the problems of today cannot be solved at the same level of thinking they were created. What I'm trying to say is that we need a different education agenda and a different professional education after school. Anyway, and the second thing is, Pliny is going to be a part of the discussion on the salon tonight on sustainable thinking and architectural forum. So you're welcome to join us there again. Thank you.
Thanks very much.